This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Do you remember the last time you sat down and hand-wrote a letter? And how did you write it? In cursive or in print? Americans today use email for almost all of their correspondence, personal and professional, which is why schools across the country no longer regard cursive handwriting as a necessary skill. Federal Common Core standards passed in 2010 do not require cursive, which has lawmakers in several states advocating to keep longhand script alive in the classroom, which has provoked a sometimes acrimonious debate. Ruth Graham is a correspondent for the Boston Globe, where she recently wrote about cursive and the Common Core. She's also a frequent contributor to Slate. And Ruth, it's great to have you back in the studio.
Great to be here.
So the Common Core standards do not have any requirements for teaching cursive. Some states are adding them. What's the status here in New Hampshire?
So New Hampshire, it was back in March, and a Republican state senator introduced a bill that initially would have required school districts to teach it, and then the language was softened to just encourage school district to teach it. So it's pretty toothless at this point, but does at least show there's interest and concern about the status of cursive.
I would say, I mean, I think people get pretty passionately riled up about dropping cursive. So what are the arguments for keeping it in the curriculum?
Right. So when I spoke to the state senator, who had raised the bill in New Hampshire, one of her big arguments is that kids need to be able to learn to read the founding documents like the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence in the original script. So that's one of the big arguments.
Could they?
Well, the interesting thing is, I mean, the script that those documents are written in is really not that similar to what kids learn in school, learn to read and write in school today. So I think, frankly, even you or I mean, I learned cursive in school, but it would be, I think, slow going for me to read the Constitution in the original script. So I'm not sure how strong that argument is, but that's one of them that you hear a lot, at least in political arguments for cursive. The best argument is probably, and I heard this from an education professor out in the Northwest, that learning cursive and just learning handwriting in general is this rare opportunity for kids in the classroom to learn a very practical skill, but that also where there's this element of aesthetics. And there really aren't too many classroom staples where you're sort of combining that element of craftsmanship with something very practical. I think more broadly, there's a lot of nostalgia. I mean, there is this sense that cursive is maybe no longer so necessary. It is kind of disappearing. I don't have great numbers on the rate at which cursive is disappearing from the classroom, but there does seem like there's some consensus that teachers are certainly spending much less time on it. Some schools cutting it altogether. And I think they're is kind of this nostalgia for a curriculum that almost all adults walking around at some point learned, and now kids today won't. So.
Right. Handwriting, however, is still taught. This is just cursive.
Exactly.
That is not.
Yeah, manuscript writing is still very widely taught, and almost all of the writing that actually goes on in the classroom at this point is still pen and paper. So we hear these stories about, you know, classrooms where every kid has an iPad, and that's happening in some pockets, but it's certainly not the standard at this point.
And maybe the time previously used for teaching cursive could better be spent typing,
yeah.
Teaching typing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you mentioned the political side of this. The Common Core is certainly a partisan issue. Is cursive a partisan issue?
Well, I wouldn't have thought so before I started researching this, but it does seem to be Republicans, Republican legislators who are bringing this up and state legislators. So even just a few weeks ago in Nevada, a state senator also raised it. And again, a Republican. The interesting thing is that in some of these cases, it's paired with a requirement that school districts teach multiplication tables, so which aren't linked, you know, educationally in any way, other than that you can kind of see this this nostalgia for a kind of 1950s style classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, they're like Glenn Beck has gone on and on about cursive on his radio show. And so it does seem to kind of be this conservative rallying point. And I think part of that might be just pushback to the notion of the Common Core.
So back to basics, better than the
exactly.
Common Core. Right?
Yeah.
And if it was good enough for us, it's good enough for our
exactly,
kids.
Exactly. Okay.
I also learned from your article that cursive was not or has not always been taught in school.
Well, handwriting itself has not always been taught in school. So, you know, if you go back to the early United States, not even all men, let alone women, would have been taught even handwriting at all. And cursive itself kind of goes through these fads. So there are different styles. In the mid-19th century, you had Spenserian script, which is this very elaborate kind of flowery script, supposedly inspired by nature. And then in the late 19th century and early 20th century, there's the Palmer method, which sort of emphasizes efficiency and is a supposedly more masculine script. So you get these sort of backlashes to different styles. And then that has now gone out of favor for an even simpler version of cursive. So it is sort of subject to these, I don't want to call them all fads, but the values of the time kind of determine the style of cursive.
Well, that's so interesting to me, Ruth, because I'm clearing out my parents' house and going through all sorts of old documents, you know, from the 1920s to the present, and seeing the letters that they saved that were written in cursive, kind of hoping for some kind of clue to personality. Not always getting it, I have to say.
Well, the point of handwriting instruction, even though we value it today, when you're looking at those letters, you're thinking of, you know, you do see the personality coming through or you'd like to see that. But in fact, the point of this instruction was uniformity. It was legibility. I mean, so the idea was that everyone would have the same handwriting, especially in the sort of pre-digital era. The point was just legibility.
I want to go back to that idea of cursive being taught is one of the few things that are in the realm of the aesthetic for a lot of kids and a lot of schools. You know, we have people who do hand lettering and calligraphy now. It's sort of in the realm of artistry rather than the utilitarian realm. And I wonder, is that the future of cursive, that it's going to be this specialized kind of thing that you pay people for rather than knowing how to do or read yourself?
I think that's very possible. And certainly the aesthetic of handwriting, I mean, you see it in fonts, you see it in, you know, invitations on Etsy and that kind of thing. So people still clearly really love the look of handwriting. And as more of us are unable to produce it, at least produce a beautiful version ourselves, I don't see the aesthetic itself going away. So I guess that's something to be encouraged by.
Well, Ruth Graham, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Ruth Graham, she's a frequent contributor to Slate and to the idea section of the Boston Globe. You'll find a link to read her article, Fighting to Save Cursive from the Common Core. That's at wordofmathradio.org. Now, we've also got some of those old school blue lined cursive practice sheets that you can print out and try your own hand at cursive. We wanted to judge the quality of our own longhand in the office, so the Word of Mouth team all wrote that classic sentence, "The quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog," with very mixed results. You can judge for yourself what our rusty skills mean for the future of cursive instruction. Again, check all that out at wordofmouthradio.org. Now stay with us for the Star Wars saga reimagined in the language of William Shakespeare. We're going to find out if the force of true mashups doth run smooth when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, a movie franchise captivated the world and has yet to let go. On December 18th, the much-anticipated seventh film in the Star Wars franchise, The Force Awakens, will open in theaters. With director J.J. Abrams replacing George Lucas at the helm, fans are anxiously awaiting the premiere. According to Disney, which now owns the Star Wars universe, the trailer for the film was viewed 88 million times within its first 24 hours online.
Chewie, we're home.
Meanwhile, in the galaxy of Ian Desher's head, that universe is being reimagined in iambic pentameter.
The desperate hour is now upon us. Please, I beg thee, sir. Oh, help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. Thou art mine only hope.
Desher is the best-selling author of William Shakespeare's Star Wars, The Empire Striketh Back and the Jedi Doth Return. Now he's applied his iambic skills to the Star Wars prequels with the newly released William Shakespeare's The Phantom of Menace. And Ian, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much.
Well, what a crazy mashup. Star Wars films in the style of Shakespeare. Whatever inspired you to start this?
About 3 years ago, three different things happened at the same time. I watched the Star Wars trilogy with some good friends of mine. I read Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which was one of the first popular mashup books. And then I went to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival with my family. Mm. And so I sort of had all three of those things swirling around in my head, Star Wars and mashups and Shakespeare. And I was at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival when I had the idea, wouldn't it be fun to rewrite Star Wars as though it were a play written by Shakespeare?
You've written three so far, and now The Phantom Menace just out. The original Star Wars trilogy was and is beloved. The prequel trilogy did really divide fans. So first things first, we should ask, where do you stand on the prequels? Do you like them?
You know, I enjoyed the prequels when they came out. I didn't love them in the same way that I loved the original trilogy. I'm of the generation that grew up with the original trilogy, and so those always had a super special place in my heart. In a way, the prequels never did. Now, that said, I was never somebody who reviled the prequels in the way that some people did, especially, you know, a lot of people were upset about The Phantom Menace and some of the things that George Lucas did with it. And I never felt that strongly, but also never thought that I was going to write the prequels. And actually, it was young people, especially people 13 and younger, you know, asking me fervently if I would do the prequels, because for them, that is Star Wars. That's the Star Wars that they know best and grew up with.
Well, I like how diplomatically you said that some people were not happy with decisions that George Lucas made. We cannot really talk about The Phantom Menace without talking about Jar Jar Binks, which in your telling is a much more nuanced character than his critics were led to believe. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, I knew that I had to do something special with Jar Jar because for so many people, he almost single-handedly ruined The Phantom Menace. Mm. You know, I sort of took pity on him, you know, and thought, well, let's do something with him that makes him not seem like he's just such a dork, you know, who's saying things, you know, that are just stupid all the time. But instead, he's actually somebody with a deep intelligence. And so what we learn is that although he is, you know, still sort of speaking like a dimwit to other characters, when he has his asides to the audience, we find out that he actually is deeply intelligent and is steering events to sort of go the way that he wants them to go. He's very interested in seeing his people, the Gungans, get back into unity with the Naboo, who are sort of the humans on his planet. And so he's orchestrating events so that they happen that way, all the while playing dumb.
All right, so let's hear just a clip of Jar Jar Binks from the film.
We shall die in here.
Just relax. We're not in trouble yet.
What yet? Monsters out there, leaking in here, all sinking in no power? When are you thinking we are in trouble?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the aside because you really pick up that Shakespearean style and wit, which lends itself to the aside. Tell us about how you used that device.
Yeah, so you know, Shakespeare never let, you know, in movies these days, in TV shows these days, sometimes you have characters who are, you know, there are sort of surprises that come out for the audience. In Shakespeare's time, that never really happened. He let his audience in on things that would end up surprising other characters, right? So he would have characters sort of speak their secret motivations to the audience so that the audience got to feel like they were in on the joke or whatever it was. So Jar Jar Binks, you know, from the very first moment we see him on Naboo as Qui-Gon is sort of running away from these droids that have pursued him down to the planet, and Jar Jar spots him. He turns to the audience, and he says, "A man approacheth, clothed in Jedi garb. Belike this man brings aid unto Naboo, such as will help my people and my land. Mayhap this is the chance I have desired, for I have wandered lo these many months, a-thinking o'er this planet's dreary fate, two people separated by their fear and prejudice, which e'er doth make us shirk from giving help unto each other. Aye, it may be that our only hope for us to be united is to realize that our two fates are tightly knit as one. Perchance this Jedi, followed by these droids, doth bring the words to break our deep mistrust. I shall make introduction, in my way, portray the part that I have learned so well. It doth befit the human prejudice to think we Gungans simple, low, and rude. I shall approach him thus, yet shall bend him to the path that shall assist us all. Put on thy simple wits now, Jar Jar Binks. Thus play the role of clown to stoke his pride.
Well, he already sounds a lot more introspective than I remember him. And I'm wondering, listening to the language, does Yoda's mixed-up grammar work well in the iambic pentameter? Here's a couple of examples. Good Master Qui-Gon, more to say have you to us?
Exactly. Yeah, when the first book came out, because of the way that things get turned around in iambic pentameter when you're fitting things into verse, a lot of people were saying, wow, everybody sounds like Yoda now, because everybody's words were sort of rearranged. And so I knew I had to do something special with Yoda, too. So all of his lines are in haiku.
My guest is Ian Desher. He is the author now of 4 books reimagining the Star Wars films written in the style of William Shakespeare. The most recent is The Phantom of Menace. In the afterwards, you mentioned your imagined stage directions for the pod race. Has anyone actually performed any of these treatments you've given them as plays?
Right now, Lucasfilm owns the copyrights for the books, and right now they are not allowing public performances or readings. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, the answer is no. I'm hopeful that at some point they may reconsider and decide to license performances. I think it would be fun to see.
How much creative control does Lucasfilms have over the content and story treatments that you are presenting?
They have the final say over basically everything. So an example with Jar Jar Binks, when I got the manuscript back from Lucasfilm with their edits, I could literally see in the margin a note from one of the publications people saying, you know, hey, story group, is this okay? And could see them comment right after that, yes, we love it. So the people who are sort of in charge of maintaining the integrity of the overall Star Wars story, the publications person was asking, you know, is this all right with you? And then they were responding, yes, it is.
Okay.
There certainly have been things that they have had me cut or change. And it's interesting as a Star Wars fan to see where those lines and those boundaries are.
This is just a guy writing Shakespeare's version of the Star Wars films. It could be construed as shtick. I mean, are you serious about this?
Well, I wouldn't claim to have anything like Shakespeare's genius. On the other hand, I didn't want to do a poor parody. You know, sometimes I've seen parodies of Shakespeare where people just sort of add S onto the end of a word,
right.
You know, any word, and that therefore is supposed to make it sound Shakespearean. You know, I learned a lot about Elizabethan grammar, about verb usage, about how some of the vocabulary is supposed to be working. Really tried to make sure my iambic pentameter was solid, and also then had a college professor of mine, the one person whom I took a Shakespeare class from, you know, review the manuscripts, and he would do things like circle a word and say, you can use this word if you want to, but Shakespeare only used it twice in his canon, so you might use this other word instead, right? So that sort of level of detail that, you know, we mere mortals can't have.
Well, I think of Shakespeare also, he reworked folklore and, you know, Plutarch's histories and revealed this timeless qualities of the human condition in his plays. Star Wars is also picking up the myth of the hero and that kind of internal struggle between good and evil. Do you think it will have a similar timelessness, the Star Wars saga?
I do, and in fact, I think it's already showing that, you know, that ability already. I mean, 40 years after, almost 40 years after the first movie came out, here we are in our culture all terribly excited about the new movie that's coming out. In some ways, George Lucas created his own pantheon, and we're all still sort of wondering what happens to the gods of that world. And I think that if Shakespeare were alive today, he would probably be writing Star Wars kinds of stories, right? Mm-hmm. He wrote the popular entertainment of his day with, as you say, these big sort of monumental themes, which I think exactly is what Star Wars is.
Well, Ian, thank you very much for speak a thing with us.
Thank you.
Ian Desher is author of several books based on the Star Wars films and written in the style of Shakespeare. His latest is The Phantom of Menace. You'll find a link to the book and more information on the release of William Shakespeare's The Clone Army Attacketh and The Tragedy of the Sith's Revenge. That's all at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, it is an auspicious day to be talking about William Shakespeare, who is believed to have been born on April 23rd in 1564 and died on the same day in 1616, exactly 399 years ago today. So to continue celebrating the life of William Shakespeare, we're going to play you one of his most famous sonnets, number 55, read by none other than the voice of Darth Vader, Mr. James Earl Jones.
Not marble nor the gilded monuments of princes shall outlive this powerful rhyme, but you shall shine more bright in these contents than unswept stone besmeared with sluttish time. When wasteful war shall statues overturn and broils root out the work of masonry, nor Mars's sword nor war's quick fire shall burn the living record of your memory. Gainst death and all oblivious enmity shall you pace forth. Your praise shall still find room, even in the eyes of all posterity that wear this world out to the ending doom. So, till the judgment that yourself arise, you live in this and dwell in lovers' eyes.
The actor James Earl Jones reading William Shakespeare's sonnet number 55. Now, we just got word that for his 400th birthday next year, the Currier Museum in Manchester will be showing one of the few remaining copies of William Shakespeare's first folio, which saved some of his greatest plays from being lost forever. Stick around for more word of mouth. Up next, one hospital's futuristic approach to calming patients with dementia, a robotic pet seal. That story's coming up after the news.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Research has long shown that interacting with animals can benefit human health, and studies indicate that pet therapy holds particular benefits for individuals with Alzheimer's and dementia-related disorders. For those patients, spending time with a therapy animal has been shown to lower blood pressure, increase appetite, and decrease agitation. A California hospital has recently embraced pet therapy, but raised some ethical concerns along the way. Angela Johnston brings us the story.
At the Livermore Veterans Hospital, there are a few animals residents can see. Wild turkeys that run around the grounds, rattlesnakes that hide out in the dry grass, therapy dogs that make weekly visits. But there's one animal in particular that Bryce Lee is always happy to see, a baby harp seal. Now, this seal isn't alive. It's a robot called Paro that was invented in Japan. But Lee doesn't necessarily know that as he pets it. He and the other senior patients here have dementia or similar conditions. Paro the seal was designed to comfort them. It's a type of tool known by scientists as a care bot.
She's happy today.
Oh, yeah. She's quite a little animal.
Lee is interacting with Paro under the supervision of Cassandra Stevenson, a recreation therapist here at the VA hospital. They're in a rec room surrounded by other residents. Because of his condition, Lee doesn't speak much, but Stevenson gets him to talk by asking him questions about the seal.
What else do you think she eats?
More fish.
More fish. I would too if I was a seal, right?
Yeah. It'd be handy.
It would be handy. You think she catches them herself?
I don't know. Not her, no.
No. Why not?
Paro is pretty adorable. It has big black eyes that open and close and follow your movements. It's about the size of a large cat, and when you pick it up, it's heavier than you'd expect. It weighs exactly 6 pounds, so it feels like you're holding a newborn baby. It charges by sucking on an electric pacifier. I wasn't expecting it, but Paro immediately drew me in.
Yeah, that's really cute.
It's also quite complex. Behind its fuzzy white exterior, the seal has sensors that detect touch, sound, light, heat, and movement, and it reacts in different ways.
We started using it with the residents, and a lot of them think it's real. They'll bark at it, they'll pet it. We had one resident who used to sing to it all the time.
That's Kathy Craig, another therapist at the VA. Craig thinks it's a useful tool for residents who are antisocial, agitated, or sad. She pronounces the robot's name Pero.
We'll bring out the Pero robot and set it down, and they'll start talking to the Pero. They'll talk to other people. It'll brighten their mood. And if they're maybe at risk of wandering and getting lost, they'll, instead of that happening, they might sit down with Pero for a while and spend some time with it.
Craig says they're even doing a study on whether seal time can replace anti-anxiety medication. Nursing and therapy staff have also noticed Pero brings out a sense of nurturing and caring in patients.
Oh, she's winking at you. Look at that.
Yeah, she did.
Wow, she must really like you today, right? Yeah, no, that's a rare thing. She's flirting with you.
Yeah, she is.
And she is.
In addition to Pero, live dog therapy is also available for the residents at the VA. A few times a month, volunteers come with their dogs and let the veterans play with them. Their interactions are very similar to when they play with Pero. In fact, the little white dog Bailey that visits frequently is the same size and color as Pero the seal.
You want to come say hi? Look, come say hi.
Veteran Bob Mountain is also a resident at the VA.
Hi, Bob.
Hi.
This is Bailey.
Hi, Bailey.
His mood changes immediately when he starts to pet Bailey.
Such a good dog. I like his ears.
I love the ears.
We like to do that to his ears.
Dr. Jeffrey Lane is the psychologist who introduced Pero to the Livermore VA 3 years ago. He says watching a particularly difficult patient interact with live therapy dogs was the reason he brought the robot to the hospital in the first place.
She was screaming and yelling a heck of a lot most of the time. Medications weren't working, and all the other things as staff were doing weren't working. But one thing I did notice is that when the dogs were brought into a room, that's when she stopped.
But as useful as they are, Lane says real animals present some problems. They're unpredictable, they can transmit disease, and most importantly, they go home at the end of the day.
So I thought to myself, is there some way we could bring animals into her room and kind of leave them there? Wouldn't that be great? For practical reasons, we can't do that with live animals, so I went to the computer, you know, fired up the old Google machine, and found an article on a blog about the Pero.
Dr. Lane thinks there isn't much of a difference if a resident plays with Bailey or Pero. He says humans are wired for connection.
People are able to connect with this robot. I mean, it's designed to behave in a way and interact with the person so that you want to touch it, you want to pet it, you want to interact with it.
But not everyone is on the same page as Dr. Lane. Shannon Valor is a philosophy professor and a virtue ethicist at Santa Clara University. She studies the way our habits influence the development of our moral character, and she thinks there are a few ethical issues to worry about when using care bots like Pero.
People have demonstrated a remarkable ability to transfer their psychological expectations of other people's thoughts, emotions, feelings to robots.
Nurses and therapists at the Livermore VA don't explicitly tell the patients Pero the seal is a robot. They play along with questions about where it lives, what type of fish it eats.
Are we deceiving them? Are we setting them up to be deceived? And is this dishonest of us to encourage?
And there's another problem. It has to do with us, the people who are actually doing the caring.
So my question is, what happens to us? What happens to our moral character and our virtues in a world where we increasingly have more and more opportunities to transfer our responsibilities for caring for others to robots, and where the quality of those robots increasingly encourages us to feel more comfortable with doing this, to feel less guilty about it, to feel, in fact, maybe like that's the best way that we can care for our loved ones.
Valor says that caring is really hard, even for people with the best intentions.
The robots are reliable. The robots are trustworthy. We don't have to worry that the robots are going to get burned out, stressed out, that they're going to lose their patience. And we have to worry about that with human caregivers.
So Valor says she doesn't deny the potential usefulness of care bots, but thinks we should be wary of our intentions when we design them.
How could we help you take better care? Not how could we do what you're doing, not how could we replace you,
but how could we help you become a better caregiver?
That means making robots that might challenge us, ones that make us work to form a relationship and encourage conversations with others.
What kind of a seal is she?
A white seal.
A white seal? Yeah.
That's all I can hear.
She's pretty domesticated, right? She's house trained.
Yeah.
Back at the Livermore VA, Bryce Lee is talking to therapist Cassandra Stevenson about Paro.
That's what seals usually eat, right?
Yeah.
The wild ones do, yeah, that's right.
Paro could be an example of the middle ground that ethicist Shannon Valor spoke of. It's helping therapists like Stevenson do her job better. It's getting patients like Lee outside of their room to socialize. But by not getting in the way of human-to-human interaction, it could help us develop our caring responsibilities rather than deplete them. At the Livermore VA, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
Coming up next, a case that brings to light a complex question that's going to become more and more common as America's population ages. Can a person with dementia or Alzheimer's consent to sex? We're going to find out what an Iowa jury decided on that question after a short break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Yesterday, an Iowa jury found 78-year-old Henry Rahans not guilty of sexually assaulting his wife, who suffered from dementia. The question of whether a person is mentally capable of consenting to sex is one likely to come up increasingly as the population ages and the number of people with Alzheimer's and dementia grows. Pam Bellick is health and science writer for The New York Times, and she's been following the case of Henry Rahans, accused of having non-consensual sex with his wife, Donna Lou, also 78, at an Iowa nursing home. We spoke to Pam on Monday when the jury began deliberating and before the acquittal to get details on a case legal experts say may be the first of its kind. I asked her what prosecutors say happened in room 12N of the Concord Care Center on May 23, 2014.
Prosecutors say that he had sexual relations with his wife, Donna Lou Rahans, at a time when he had been told just about a week earlier by staff at the nursing home that because of her dementia, she was unable to give consent. It's interesting because the evidence that they have is, as often in these types of cases, there isn't, you know, a whole lot of evidence, but even in this case, it seems a little bit thin, I would say.
Well, the timing, a key factor here, as you mentioned, This was 7 or 8 days after her mental state was judged to be what and by whom?
Well, so she obviously had Alzheimer's. She had been put into this nursing home in March of 2014 by her daughters. And it's important to note that this is a second marriage. Both Donna and Henry were widowed after marriages that lasted a long time, and they married in 2007, I believe, and by all accounts, they had just a very loving, very devoted marriage. And as Donna started to deteriorate, her daughters, at least two of her three daughters, became concerned that maybe Henry wasn't taking enough care of her in the sense of not being as vigilant of how she was dressing or the way that she was forgetting things. Mm-hmm. And they felt that she would be better off in a nursing home. And she was evaluated. There are a lot of different ways to evaluate dementia patients, none of them foolproof or perfect. But the principal ways that we arrive at these kinds of diagnoses is by giving people memory tests and tests of sort of cognitive function. Those are the scales that we have. And she did very, very poorly on those tests. That the question at issue in this case is, do those tests tell us anything about her emotional willingness to be physically intimate with her husband?
Mm-hmm. That's the key here.
That's the key thing.
Now, her husband visited her twice a day. He said they would often say the rosary, did admit that there was sexual contact that she would sometimes ask for. What did he say in his defense about this particular accusation?
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, he also, by the way, was, until this case happened, a Republican state legislator for 9 terms, very well respected and sort of very prominent in his community, and that's sort of some background here as well. And he would drive from 2 hours each way from Des Moines when the legislature was in session and visit her in the nursing home, you know, early in the morning, late at night, just so that he could see her. His sort of specific defense to these charges is that it didn't happen that day. She had been transferred from a private room to a double room that day. She had a roommate, an 85-year-old woman, and he had come to visit her. And he says that, yes, he pulled the curtain between the beds and he was helping her, you know, get ready for bed, and maybe they were whispering, but that he just doesn't recall having any kind of sexual interaction with her that day. She was kind of annoyed because she didn't want to be in a double room and she wouldn't have been in the mood. That's mm-hmm. his contention. But sort of the broader contention is that he feels that their emotional bond and their physical bond was able to sustain itself even in the course of her dementia, and that he would never initiate anything physical with her if she wasn't amenable to it. He's saying, you know, we had this loving relationship, and she was always happy to see me, and she wanted to be affectionate. We were always holding hands. And in fact, that particular description is one that everybody seems to bear out. The nursing home staff, even as they were the ones who reported this and testified that, you know, she was unable to consent, they also said that she was always happy to see her husband and that he was very affectionate with her and she affectionate with him. There's no allegation here at all by anybody that there was a struggle, that there was any kind of resistance, that she was uncomfortable in any way.
Well, of course. So the question is, of course, was she able to enjoy or understand what it meant to have sex at that point? What is the policy at the Concord Care Center regarding sexual relations between people who are clients there? And do you know of examples of any other elder and memory care facilities that are dealing with this?
Right. So one thing that I found really fascinating about this whole issue is that if you talk to people who work in nursing homes, who run nursing homes, who have had relatives in nursing homes, it's a very open secret that sex happens, that sexual urges happen well into your golden years, and even and sometimes especially with people who are suffering from dementia. Sometimes it's dementia can be disinhibiting and make people more likely to sort of want some kind of sexual activity than they might have been otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But very, very few nursing homes have really any sort of explicit way of addressing this.
Mm-hmm.
Concord Care Center in Iowa said they certainly allowed consensual sex between consenting adults. They say they never had any kind of case like this. They'd never had to tell a spouse, as they did 8 days before this alleged incident, that they didn't think that she had the ability to consent. So it's a very unusual case. And they say that the reason why they even raised that question was that one of Donna's daughters apparently was kind of concerned that she was hearing her mother talk about sort of sexual activity with Henry.
Mm-hmm.
And she may have been alarmed. Maybe mom doesn't usually talk like that. And so she said to the nursing home, you know, I'm concerned about this. That's one of the reasons they moved her into the double room. And that's the reason why they wrote on the care plan, you know, they explicitly added that question, which is she competent to consent to sex? Because that's not a normal question for them to ask. And ideally, in the nursing home world, it really shouldn't be. This is something that should be addressed head on. The one nursing home that is doing this and has pioneered this as of 1995 is a home called the Hebrew Home at Riverdale in the Bronx. And they have this very, really kind of progressive, thoughtful policy where they encourage physical intimacy when it's consensual, and they discourage anything that might be alarming to other residents, any kind of public displays, anything like that. And when there's an issue of competence, what they will do is they train their staff to be very alert to body language, to mood, to any suggestion of a patient being uncomfortable. They also ask questions which I think are kind of interesting, though. They would ask somebody like Mrs. Rayons, they would say, you know, do you know what sex is? Is this a person you would like to have sex with? And so not everybody is going to be able to, in this kind of condition, is going to be able to actually articulate answers to that, but some people would be.
Are people with dementia capable of saying yes to sex, and who decides? That question was at the center of a case against an Iowa man who was acquitted yesterday of sexually assaulting his wife, who did have dementia. We spoke with Pam Bellick, who reported on the case for the New York Times on Monday when the case went to the jury. So the thorough attention of staff at the Hebrew home is the exception, not the rule. Do you think that ageism is at play here, the thinking being that the elderly just shouldn't be having sex, so we're not going to deal with it?
I kept hearing that. I honestly don't know if that was sort of a facile answer, but I did hear that from people who study this issue in nursing homes, and our story got something like 1,200 comments and there were online, and there were a number of people commenting about how nursing home staff just kind of just find it kind of icky, the idea of older people having sex. I don't know. I mean, it would be kind of discouraging that in this day and age we're kind of, if we're not really in a place where we can realize that, yeah, people are living longer, and they're living longer, you know, in a physically healthy way, and there's Viagra, and, you know, a lot of these folks have gone through a much more progressive era now. You know, we have the baby boomer generation starting to enter nursing homes. It would seem kind of extraordinary not to expect that people who have had an active sex life throughout their life would not want to continue that as they age if they could.
You noted in your article that physical intimacy can benefit dementia patients, according to some experts, you know, calming them, maybe easing loneliness, possibly even aiding physical health. What does this mean for caregivers, facility states watching this case?
Well, I think if there is a conviction, it could really have a sort of chilling effect on nursing homes and on states feeling that they have to, you know, maybe be much more vigilant and watch out for these situations and maybe enact kind of preventive policies. It would really be a sort of shot across the bow in a direction that would probably cause a lot of tightening up of policies. If he's acquitted, it may not spur any dramatic movement right away, but I think just the fact that this case has occurred and that, you know, it's gotten so much attention should and hopefully will cause people in this arena, people who work with dementia patients, people who run nursing homes, and family members to just think about this issue and think about, you know, is there a way that we can deal with this to prepare ahead of time? Are there things that we need to address ahead of time? One of the more interesting suggestions that I've heard was the idea of including this kind of a discussion in an advance directive, and sort of saying, you know what, if I fall into a state where I don't have all my faculties, I'd still like to sleep with my husband, or I really wouldn't. Now, of course, you know, you can't, as with most things in advance directives, you can't always know if you're going to, you know, would you have made that decision in the moment. But at least thinking ahead, you can express a preference. And it was interesting, one of the experts that I talked to who was very sort of pro intimacy for dementia patients said that he had talked to his wife about this, and she had said, if this ever happens to me, you know, I don't want to have sex. And he said, okay, I'll respect that. So people are going to have different preferences. They're going to think, and I think the biggest issue that this calls attention to is that this is something that needs to be discussed without shame, without embarrassment. If done right, it can, as you say, you know, intimacy can have benefits to people throughout life, and if done wrong, it can have harmful effects. So it would be good if we can try to think about it in a more cogent way, so that we can be prepared for these kind of odd cases that might come up.
Pam Bellick is a health and science writer for the New York Times. Her team, by the way, was awarded a Pulitzer Prize on Monday. And we did speak to her about her article, Sex, Dementia, and a Husband on Trial at 78, earlier this week. That was before yesterday, when an Iowa jury acquitted Henry Rahans of sexually assaulting his wife, who suffered from dementia. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There is a lot more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, where your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast awaits you. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR on iTunes. And if you like the podcast, you can write a review, pass it along, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray,
with help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.